They say hundreds of scientific studies prove genetically modified foods are safe to eat. But then along came Dr. Judy Carman's scientific study showing severe stomach and uterus inflammation from GM feeds fed to pigs. And Dr. Eric Seralini's scientific study showing cancerous tumors from GM feeds fed to rats. These conflicting studies on the safety of GM foods lead us to ask, whose scientific studies should we believe?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 972nd edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Port Stanley who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Aaron Shore on the boards. Hello, Aaron.
Good morning.
Have a question for you, Aaron.
I have an answer.
Oh, good. The question is, whose science do you believe? Those who say GMOs are safe to eat, or those who say GMOs may not be safe to eat?
I would have to go with the latter. I don't think they're safe at all.
Why?
Well, why would you want to put something in your body that's been genetically modified?
Because they say it's safe. At least that's what a lot of people say. Folks, the genetically modified foods we eat, and we do eat a lot of genetically modified foods, come from life that has been re-engineered by taking genes from one species and injecting them into the genes of another species to create, in effect, a new species. The most popular uses of GM technology include creating plants infused with pesticides that kill insect pests and plants that can withstand the herbicides that kill weeds. With this GM technology, and get this, one farmer may now grow 1,000 acres of crops with no pests or weeds. And ladies and gentlemen, make no mistake, for growers of crops, this is one big freaking deal. Holy smokes, 1,000 acres, no weeds, no pests. Wow. Some consumers, however, ask, hey, what's in this technology for us, other than food that has been infused with pesticides and immersed in herbicides? Like, hundreds of scientific studies have proved genetically modified foods are safe to eat. Some scientific studies suggesting that they are not so safe to eat. Examples of the contrary studies include Dr. Judy Carman's showing that severe stomach inflammation and uterus inflammation from GM feeds fed to pigs, and Dr. Eric Seralini's showing cancerous tumors from GM feeds fed to rats. We have posted the animals involved in these studies on the homepage at metrofarm.com. So if you wish to see what they look like, click on and there they are. Folks, the conflict between these two ways of seeing the world, these scientific studies pointing in opposite directions, leads us to ask today, whose science should we believe? And we've been trying to find somebody who would stand up and say, well, look at these two contrary studies and give us an insight into something that might be going wrong there. And we've asked around. And finally, our good friends at Ketchum Advertising, who represent the U.S. Farmers and Ranchers Alliance, provided us with two of the nation's leading genome scientists. And today we have them on the line with us. We're so happy to have them aboard. First of all, we have Dr. Allison Van Inenem, who is professor of animal genomics and biotechnology at UC Davis. Allison, did I get your last name right?
Yes, you did. Thanks, Michael.
All right, good. Thank you for joining us today. You're a professor of animal genomics. What the heck is that?
Well, basically using information about DNA to make genetic improvements in animals is what I work in, and I particularly work in beef cattle.
Okay.
My emphasis.
Good. So you're one who is actually involved in doing exactly what we're going to be talking about today. So we're really happy to have you aboard. Allison, we always ask our guests who pays the way for your research.
Sure. I'm a publicly funded scientist. I work at an academic research institution, UC Davis, and the USDA is a public organization that funds my research.
Good. Also with us today, we have Wayne Parrott, who is the professor of plant genomics and breeding at the University of Georgia, a bulldog. Welcome aboard, Wayne. Pleased to have you.
Hey, good morning, and thanks for hosting us.
You bet. Professor of animal genomics, so you do the same thing that Allison does with plants instead of animals.
That's correct.
Good enough. And who pays your way?
I have several different groups. Certainly, the USDA is one of them. The National Science Foundation is another one. Department of Energy and the United Soybean Board.
Great. Now, Wayne, you're a professor of plant genomics and breeding, so I would like to ask you an off-topic question that I've always wanted to ask and never found the right person. And so everybody out there kind of plug your ears when I ask this. Doctor, do you think plants enjoy sex?
Well, they certainly have physiological responses when they get pollinated, so I guess there are many ways to interpret that.
Okay. I just thought I'd ask. It's a crazy question, I know, but I've always wondered. So,
but, you know, I think the important thing there is to recognize that plants do have sex all the time, and that is one of the reasons that we can modify them.
Ah.
And I don't think most people understand that plants have sex all the time.
And it's how we've been modifying them for thousands of years, right?
Exactly.
Okay, good to know. So I'd like to set the stage a little bit here. First of all, we've had hundreds of industry and academic studies through the past decade or so that say GM foods are safe to eat. Who does these studies? Start with you, Allison.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think you've sort of set this up as if there's some studies funded by industry that show one thing and some studies funded by activists that show another thing. And whose science do you believe? And I think maybe the way to approach it is to look at all of the studies that have been done by independent academic scientists throughout the world and the consensus of scientific bodies in this regard. And so there are many, many studies that have been funded by independent, you know, USDA-type organizations that have no preconceived idea what the outcome should be, and those studies overwhelmingly show the safety of genetically engineered feed. Similar to, you know, the debate over climate change and vaccine, there's a vast literature that show one perspective, and that is the safety of these studies, and then a couple of odd studies that show the opposite. And so I think, as a scientist, I always go with the bulk of scientific consensus and the opinion of the Academy of National Sciences, the American Association of Science, to make my determination, because they look at all of the data, not just a single study or one or two studies.
Okay, fair enough. Do you have anything to add to that, Wayne?
I would just like to point your attention to the European Commission, and they published their results of their studies, 20 years of studies. They spent like 300 million euros on it, and they arrived at the same conclusion that they couldn't find anything different from conventional crops in it.
Okay. So what you're saying in essence then, that all of the studies, except for a couple of them, say that GM foods are safe?
Correct. Or they should say that, you know, there's no difference between them and the food that we normally eat.
Okay.
Which is a standard that we go for.
Let's look quickly at the Carmen study. And the Carmen study came about because a pig farmer in the Midwest was wondering why his pigs were having trouble reproducing and whatnot. So he kind of figured, I think this might have something to do with the GM foods I'm feeding, because when I take them off GM foods, they get better. And so he commissioned Dr. Judy Carmen and Associates, who is a professor of genomics in Australia, to conduct a study. And she did, and found that a significant increase, 25% of the pigs fed GM foods were more likely to have enlarged uterus, and 260% of the pigs were more likely to have severe stomach inflammation. And the other study, the Eric Seralini in Italy, found that a significant number of rats that he fed GM foods were died a premature death to liver and kidney failure, and the others were experiencing huge increases in tumor rates for the female rats. And so we have these two sets of studies, essentially the bulk of the world saying that GM foods are safe, and a couple of studies. Some say there are a lot of them, too. Some I have received an email that said there are hundreds of studies to the contrary. But the two we're looking at today are Carmen and Seralini. And we're going to ask you all, who do you think, whose science do you think we should believe? Those of the industry and those of the critics. Right back. Do stay tuned on The Food Chain.
Get this, you can earn a 5-6 or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
You can be old or young,
rich or poor,
married or single.
You can own land outright
or lease it year to year.
You can grow small fruits on prairie bench lands,
house plants in coastal valleys,
flowers on steep wooded hillsides,
vegetables in the city green belts,
and ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
Get all the help you need to get growing at metrofarm.com.
Get the complete guide to growing high value specialty crops for the city at metrofarm.com.
Get experts to look at your land and assess which crops to grow at metrofarm.com.
Get advice on how to plan and develop your project at metrofarm.com.
And get news about the business of farming for the city.
Yes, you can earn a 5-6 or even a 7-figure income by farming high-value specialty crops on a small parcel of land in or near the city.
Grow for the money today at metrofarm.com. That's metrofarm.com.
Hey folks, some scientific studies say that GM genetically modified foods are safe to eat. Others say that maybe not, maybe there's a problem here. And so today we're trying to figure out which science we believe. And that's the question on the table today. With us we have Allison Van Inenem, who is a professor of animal genomics at UC Davis. And also we have Wayne Parrott, who is a professor of plant genomics at University of Georgia. We have an Aggie and we have a Bulldog with us today. And we have, of course, have you as well. You're invited to participate in the show today at 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. So we have studies pointing in opposite directions here. So let's start about, first of all, how on earth do you go about designing a animal feeding study so that it's scientific? So we'll start with the plant part of it, the feeds, and I guess that would be you, Wayne. What do we do? How do we start managing this study so that it's scientific with respect to the feeds that we're going to feed them?
Sure. In all cases, whenever one does a feeding study, there are all sorts of traps for the unwary, all sorts of pitfalls that people have found out over the years. So after doing studies for 50, 60 years, there is a best practices that the industry has established, you know, the scientific field has established in order to ensure that we don't fall into these pitfalls.
Oh, is it, there's internationally recognized standards for feeding studies then?
Pretty much. So in most of the top journals, you know, they look at the animal number, they look at the experimental design, they look at data analysis. There's a standard list that we all look at. Mm-hmm. As far as the food goes, the most important thing is that you have to compare apples to apples. And not just any apple to any apple. You know, you can't compare, say, a Granny Smith to a Red Delicious. You have to have exact same variety of apple, grown at the same time, prepared the same way. You know, if you have one that's been in the storage for 6 months and one off the tree, you're going to get different results.
Well, so, but doesn't one of them have to be different? Otherwise, you're not comparing anything.
Compare. So, exactly right. So, the idea is that there's only one difference in
case.
It would be the gene that was put into the apple. So, it would have to be one gene difference, but then it has to be the same apple that's the same age, grown in the same place, handled the same way.
Okay, so you have an experimental apple, and then you have a control apple.
Correct.
Okay, good. Let's turn to the animals. Allison, that would be your purview.
Sure. Thanks, Michael. You ask a really good question, and I'm glad you brought this up, because there absolutely are internationally agreed upon approaches to feeding studies. As animal scientists, we use this all the time. And I think that's some of the frustration with these studies, is that they haven't complied with them. There's feeding study protocols put out by the International Life Science Institute that details in great detail how you would go about doing an animal feeding study like the pig study that Carmen did. And there's no compliance at all with that particular approach. And I think as animal scientists...
I'm trying to take the audience from the very basic here.
Okay, sure.
How do you manage animals when you put them into an animal feeding study?
Sure. So some of the things you want to do is have replicates, and not just a single pen, but rather multiple replicates of pens. You want to treat them all the same. You want to do a randomized block design. You want to statistically analyze them in an appropriate way. Make sure that their feed is equivalent nutritionally and only differs in the GM in this particular case. You want to make sure they're healthy. And in the case of the pig study, there was 15% death loss, which is huge for post-wean pigs.
So then the idea with respect to the animals is kind of the same then with respect to the feeds, is that you want everything to be pretty much the same.
Correct.
And you want to have the animals separated into the experimental group or groups, and the pigs and the control group. So you want one doing everything normally and the other group doing everything normally except for the one variable that you're trying to test.
Correct, and ideally you'd have more than one, because just statistically you'd like to have a larger number in order to ensure that it wasn't just a spurious result as a result of, you know, a couple of pigs getting sick in your control group, for example.
Which can happen.
Yeah, and so you always want to replicate and have multiple control groups and multiple treatment groups.
Okay, now how do we go about, here's the interesting question, how do we go about eliminating bias in a study?
Well, the traditional way is you do a blinded study. That is, you don't know which animal is your control group and which animal is your treatment group, so that you don't introduce, you know, intentional biases or unintentional biases in the researcher when taking observations.
So then you want to kind of blindfold everybody, as it were.
Yeah, not exactly blindfold, but very. I mean, it's very well established that the way you do that is you have a diet A and a diet B, and you don't know which one's A and which one's B, and you take all your observations in the absence of that knowledge, and only the person that's running the trial that's not taking the observations has the key to say which is diet A and which is diet B.
Okay, so then the idea is to eliminate as many variables as possible in the feed, in the animals, and in the people doing the observations, correct?
Correct.
Okay, and then you have kind of like a check, which is called a peer review, correct?
Right.
How does that work?
Well, the way that works is that the paper is sent to a journal, and ideally you send it to a journal whose expertise is animal feeding studies, because they're going to have a peer review group that's going to be familiar with what is acceptable protocol and experimental design, and then you'll have two or potentially three independent, unknown researchers will evaluate the study and come back with their response to that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So that pretty much sum it up, Wayne. Did we miss anything there?
She pretty much got it.
Okay, good. Lynn, let's look at the studies, the kinds of studies that feeding studies that are done to ensure that the changes that we make in our food chain are safe changes. First of all, let me turn to the government. Does the government ensure the safety of animal of changes in animal feeds? Does the government do feeding study experiments, Wayne?
So let's just begin by explaining how safety is established. And actually, safety is not established by feeding trials, because there's much more precise ways of doing it. If you want something to be, if there's a change in the safety of something, it has to come from the change of something that was added to it. So when the first line of testing that gets done is to tear the GMO apart and make sure that we have not added anything that was not intentional there. And because we're in a global economy, it's not just good enough that the USDA and FDA look at the data. All the major importing countries are going to want to either repeat the studies or look at them as well. So by the time it gets to you, it's been looked at by probably 13, 14, 15 safety agencies around the world.
Okay, but let's go back and help me out here.
Sure.
Does the government test these things for foods? Does the government conduct feeding studies?
So it depends what country you're in.
Our country?
No, we do not require feeding studies. Canada does not require feeding studies. It's primarily a European requirement.
Okay, so...
And the reason being that they don't have the sensitivity that the lab tests have.
Okay, so the government does not... where does this government... I guess the government then turns to somebody to say, you've conducted the feeding study. So that would be industry?
So, again, I think the part to clarify is that the safety studies, and they're conducted by different groups depending on where you are in the world, is what the government requires and wants to look at. Then some countries have a second layer, which is the feeding studies. And then, again, that also depends on where you are as far as who does it. And quite frequently it is the company that is submitting the request.
Okay, folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. We're talking about the scientific feeding studies that tell us whether the genetically modified foods are or are not safe to eat. And we have two industry-leading scientists, one from University of California, Davis, Allison Van Eneman, who is a professor of animal genomics and biotechnology, Wayne Parrott, who is a professor of plant genomics and breeding at University of Georgia. We have an Aggie, and we have a Bulldog, and we have you. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Whose science should we believe? They say genetically modified foods are safe to eat. Hundreds of studies say just that. But there are some studies now, a few out there, who say maybe not. One of the contrary studies from Dr. Judy Carman, who looked at pigs and noticed that pigs fed GM foods were developing severe stomach inflammation and enlarged uterus. And also Eric Seralini over there in Italy, who fed some GM foods to rats, and the rats developed tumors and died prematurely and this and that. And you can see those animals on the homepage at metrofarm.com. And so we're wondering if there's any validity to those studies, holy smokes, or if they're aberrant and we should only pay attention to the other studies. So we're kind of going through how this animal feeding studies works. And first thing we learned is that the federal government of the United States does not test GM foods, so that evidently we have to turn to somebody else to find out what kind of animal feeding studies they have done. I guess that would leave us with the industry studies. Now, Allison, will you tell us how the industry studies work?
Well, when you say industry, do you mean academia?
No, I'd like to separate out academia. I would like to take that conversation for later, because hopefully academia is the one or a group of study makers that does not have skin in the game. So I'd like to set them aside for a little bit and talk about the industry studies when a business comes up with a new genetically modified plant, they have to say this plant is safe. We know it's safe because we tested it. And that's what I'd like to learn. How do they go about testing it? Who decides how they test something, Allison?
Right. Well, I mean, I guess your question is what type of food safety testing does the FDA look at when they're looking at the approval of a genetically engineered crop? And there is a consultation process that all of the crops that have been commercialized have been through, and feeding studies have been involved in some of them. They're not mandated, as Wayne alluded to, but they have been done in a number of cases. And there they would be set up according to approved protocols, like I mentioned, internationally approved protocols like the OECD consensus protocols. And they compare animals that are eating genetically engineered feed to isogenic lines of the same feed without the genetically engineered construct, and have a look at how those animals perform. Typically, that's a 90-day feeding study, but I think you can't just ignore the vast literature of independent studies that have been done.
Yeah, but I'd like to pick that up down the line here a minute. So what we're saying here is that the industry essentially does its own studies and then presents the information to the Food and Drug Administration. And
the same way that drug testing studies are done by Merck or whoever, and the data is presented to the FDA for drug approval, for example. So that's typically how development occurs. It's not the public sector paying for the development of products coming to the market.
Okay, fair enough.
And also, maybe you want to add that they don't do all this stuff in-house. They contract a lot of materials out. They're specialty testing companies that have been around forever and whose reputation and ability to stay in the market depends on getting their tests right.
Okay. Then is there a way of measuring, looking at, I mean, I just look at the Food and Drug Administration and see that Monsanto's Michael Taylor is in the catbird seat there. Do you not see any danger of bias in that situation where a biotech company presents a biotech product to a government agency run by a biotech person?
I've heard this kind of conspiracy idea, and I guess having worked or seen the people at the FDA, I mean, these are scientists that are looking at this data, and the suggestion that they're all somehow complicit in some cover-up with Monsanto, I think, just stretches the imagination. You know, they're looking at the data that's being presented to them, and then it also, as Wayne alluded to, gets presented to independent evaluations throughout the world in many different countries, and I think it stretches the imagination to think there's some large conspiracy here that's favorable to industry. I think that these regulators are interested in the safety of the population and do a credible job.
Okay, fair enough. I just have to ask, you know, it's my job. Let's go to the no skin in the game feeding studies, which would be universities, right? Okay. How does a university approach its feeding studies? I mean, how does that work? Wayne?
I'm going to lob that one to Allison.
Allison, okay.
Primarily on the animal side.
Bulldog to the daggy. Here we go.
Okay, well, I mean, if you wanted to set up a feeding study, like to have a look.
First of all, why would you set it up?
Well, to have independent confirmation of whether or not these products are performing. In my case, I might be interested in how cattle perform on genetically engineered corn, for example, and see if there's any issues there. Mm-hmm. I would get an academic research license with the company whose seed I was interested in.
Wait a minute. What does that mean, an academic research license?
It's basically a research license to enable me to use, for example, genetically engineered corn and the isogenic line associated with that in a research study that's a feeding trial.
You mean if the patent holder has to look at your study approve whether you're going to do it or not?
They don't have to. They don't do anything like that. But you do have to get permission to use a patented product. But the researchers can publish their research findings, and they're not required or obliged to contact the company in any way. So if I wanted to do a study tomorrow, I totally could do that. And obviously, I'd have to grow the seed and the isogenic control, perform the study, and I would do that according to internationally approved guidelines, because that prevents you from having too small of a sample size, too few control groups, such that you'll get spurious and incorrect information. So I think, you know, the animal scientists have put a lot of thought into getting these documents right in terms of how to run these studies, and to ignore that and just run a study ignoring best practices really is what's causing a lot of these issues with these studies that show very aberrant results, because they're not complying with well understood best practices for the design of these animal feeding studies.
Okay, and we're going to get to those studies here in the next segment, but I have to ask you the tough question. The organization Food and Water Watch put out a white paper called Public Research, Private Gain, in which they assert that industry is now providing 25% of the funding for ag-related research at at American universities to the extent of some $750 million a year. Does that have a way of influencing research, that money?
Well, I personally don't take any industry money, and there are...
Does your school?
There are researchers here, I'm sure, that do, but there are public monies available, for example, through the Biotech Risk Assessment Grant of the USDA, where you can actually do biotech risk assessment that's funded by the public in order to carry out independent studies. And there are certainly many independent studies that have been carried out that haven't been funded by industry, by academic scientists in the literature, and they never get any attention because they've been well designed and they don't show any dramatic differences, and so they're not at all sensational, and you can't put a picture up on the website.
Okay, well, and speaking of those pictures, we're going to turn you two loose, the Aggie and the Bulldog, to tear into the Carmen and Seralini studies that seem to assert that GM foods may not be safe to eat. Do stay tuned on the Food Chain. Whose science do you believe? The science of those who say GM foods are safe to eat? Hundreds of studies say so. Or the studies that say maybe not so safe to eat? There are a few of them, a couple of them we're picking up today and going after to see what the heck is wrong with them. One of the studies is from Dr. Judy Carmen from Australia, who looked at the commercial pigs of Howard Flieger up in the Midwest and noticed or demonstrated through her scientific study that the pigs were developing severe stomach inflammation, turned the stomachs red, oh my goodness, and also enlarged uterus in the female pigs. So also we're looking at Eric Seralini in Italy, who fed a bunch of rats genetically modified foods and noticed that they developed tumors and developed kidney failure and liver failure and had some problems there. So we're looking at these studies and saying, holy smokes, are they for real? And I've been asking around all over the world for people who would stand up and tear these studies apart and tell us what's wrong with them. And today we have two of the nation's brightest genomic scientists to do just that. We have Allison Van Inenum from the University of California, Davis, she and Aggie, and Wayne Parrott from the Professor of Plant Genomics and Breeding at the University of Georgia, and he a bulldog. An Aggie and a bulldog to go after Carmen and Seralini. So let's start. What on earth is wrong with these studies, Allison?
Well, I guess, again, as I alluded to earlier, they haven't been designed the way that you would set up a feeding trial, and there's a couple of major issues. For example, Wayne alluded to making sure you're comparing apples and apples, and the diets in the Carmen study were not controlled for comparing apples and apples. They just went and purchased it at the local feed mill. There's a couple of other
things. Did they buy different kinds of food to feed them?
Well, they were both corn, but there's no indication that they tested the feed to ensure a composition, which is a really fundamental
thing. Oh, I see what you're saying, then. It may well have been, like Wayne was saying, one kind of corn from one part of the country to another kind of corn from another part of the country.
They weren't grown in the same environment at the same time, an isogenic line. So that's a big concern. But I think the one I'm going to pick on is the red stomach, because that's the most dramatic picture and the one you've got on your website.
Yeah, that's the Dr. Carmen
right.
Study about the... okay, go ahead, fire away.
So I guess the question is, what does a red stomach mean? And it's misinterpreted to suggest that redness is indicative of inflammation, and that's not actually the case. In order to determine whether it's inflamed or not, you'd have to do very standard histology or histopathology to see whether or not the stomach is actually inflamed. The red color can be due to many different things.
Maybe it was eating too many strawberries.
No, particularly acid in the stomach, and those pigs had been off feed for 16 hours, which can cause the redness. So there's a conflation between redness and inflammation.
Would that not show up in the control group then?
Well, if you look, and it's kind of interesting, over 90% of the controls had some level of inflammation on their stomachs.
Isn't there a certain amount of inflammation that pigs get from eating finely ground meals? I mean, isn't that kind of like standard?
That's correct, but again, we're talking about inflammation, and what they measured was redness, which is not the standard for evaluating inflammation. The standard for evaluating inflammation is a histological analysis of the sample with a slide. Like when you go to the doctor and you've got a mole, he doesn't go, oh, that doesn't look too red, I don't think that's cancer. He takes a sample and does a histological analysis, the same way you should with a pig. And there's a very, very well-designed study that went by all the consensus protocols in pigs that was done in Ireland that came out last year, where they did exactly that. They did histological samples between control and not, and GM feed pigs fed for a whole lifetime, and they found no significant difference in the,
okay,
in the inflammation.
So you're saying the big problem here is that they didn't take a biopsy, I guess you'd call it.
And, correct.
And do, stick it under a microscope and see. Okay, Wayne, what about you?
Yeah, pretty much when one is presenting results, you have to make sure that you've ruled out all other possible causes. And Allison mentioned there's many cases of red stomach. It's stress. You know, if the GM pigs were the last ones to be slaughtered, they'd be more stressed out. And then you mentioned the uterus, and that's exactly what happens to pigs as they start puberty.
Well, so, wouldn't that happen in the control group, too? Wouldn't the control group get the same puberty that the...
It's an artifact of the way they did the stats. The sample size, again, is smaller than recommended, and it's really just one uterus that's off by 0.02% of body weight. So it's really not significant if you use a more...
I thought it was 25%.
Of a tiny number. It is, but it's such a tiny... It's a 25% of a tiny number, still a tiny number.
Oh, okay. Well, fair enough. What about the Seralini study? Allison?
Well, that, I can't believe I'm here in 2014 doing the Seralini study. The major thing there, and I think that's been mentioned many, many times, and you've got the pictures of the tumors there, is that this study was done, a two-year study in a line of rat that is predisposed to developing tumors as they age. Mm-hmm. And 80% of these animals get tumors irrespective of any treatment by 2 years of age.
Weren't those the same rats, though, that Monsanto used to prove
right.
that the feed was safe?
Yeah, there's a fundamental difference in a short-term toxicity study, a 90-day study.
Okay, we're going to have to pick that up. We have to take our last break. I wish I had 13 more hours, but we will be right back.
Welcome back.
We will pursue this with Allison Van Inenum and Wayne. Oh, we'll be right back. An Aggie and a Bulldog. Allison Van Inenum and Wayne Parrott, and you. Do stay tuned. We will be right back. Well, industry fed its rats GM foods for 90 days and then took the rats out of the cage and looked at them and said, these rats are fine. Eric Seralini took the same rats, stuck them in a cage and fed them GM foods for their lifespan and noticed that a lot of the rats started dying early and some of them had tumors. And that's kind of the experiment. I guess both of them were under controlled circumstances, which is to say one bunch of rats in one section of the cages was fed GM foods and the other section was fed control, regular, old, normal foods. So what on earth is wrong with that experiment, Allison?
Well, as I said before the break, the problem is that when you're designing the two-year type trials, you want to be careful to avoid strains of rats that are known to have a predisposition to tumor. And the OECD guidelines say that survivability problems exist for the Sprague-Dawley rat line, and you should use a line that's not predisposed to cancer if you're going to do these two-year cancer studies. And that's the real problem, because you would get that spontaneously in 80% of the animals, irrespective of what they're eating. And so it's really important, if you're going to do a long study, to make sure you've got a strain of animal that's going to survive that long study and doesn't have other things causing the cancer that's unrelated to your test article, in this case genetically engineered feed. The other thing is the really small sample size. So there was one group of 10 control males and one group of 10 control females, and then 9 different treatment groups. And you've got a problem there because you have multiple comparisons coming back to that single control group, and you have to adjust for that. And if you actually adjust for that multiple comparisons, none of the statistics in this study come out as being significant. And so I think that it's like a fishing expedition almost, looking for a problem, and that there's just a really badly designed study. And that's why the academic community has been so upset about this study, because it didn't comply with consensus protocols, which have been established.
There seems to be some in the academic community that aren't all that upset with it, but some are. Which leads me to the big question. We only have a couple minutes left. I'll start with you, Wayne. How on earth are we out here in the world who, you know, go to breakfast and for a look at our box of Wheaties and go, oh my goodness, is this safe to eat? How should we go about figuring out which studies to listen to?
I think you need to go to authoritative sources. You know, FDA's website is a really good place to start. EFSA, the European Food Safety Authority website, is another really great place to start. In the end...
And you're saying these sources are not biased? FDA
And Food Canada, I think those are probably the by far the most trustworthy of all.
Allison?
Well, I think that's a location to go to look for what the consensus international protocols are. I would argue that the best place to go is the peer-reviewed literature from independent academic scientists, not funded by activists, not funded by industry, but funded by the public.
Where do we find them?
Well, Google is an amazing thing. There's lists that are located on the Federation of Animal Science Societies. They have literally hundreds of studies listed there from independent academic scientists, or the consensus opinion of our major scientific societies, like the National Academy of Sciences, who have come out saying that there are no unique safety concerns associated with GE foods. The American Medical Association. You know, if you can't trust our independent scientific organizations, then I'm not sure who you can trust.
And that's, Allison, that's where I put Allison, my
trust. Yep.
I trust everybody.
Good on you, Michael.
All right. Thank you, Allison Van Inenum from UC Davis. Also, thank you so much, Wayne Parrott from the University of Georgia. And especially thank you all for tuning in. Remember Michael Olson's first law of the food chain? Agriculture is the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles. Thank you all.
Amen.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.